Welcome to Leadership Amplified. I'm Karen Morley, your host. I am an executive coach, and my goal in my practice is to help leaders get more impact with less effort. I'm keen to challenge overwork to help leaders rediscover their purpose and to rebalance their life so that they can beat chronic stress and burnout. And so the purpose of the podcast is to highlight stories of leaders and great thought leaders who are helping to do just that. Today's conversation is with Tim Drinkle. He's the head of learning and organisational development at Metro Trains in Melbourne, and he's been there for about 18 months. He's worked in a variety of different roles, focusing on organisational capability, learning and leadership development, culture, and career development in organisations like Melbourne Water, Simplot, NBN, Salmat, Telstra, Origin Energy, AGL, and Aegis. So Tim is an HR learning and organizational development professional who has a proven ability to assess business needs through effective and collaborative consultation with stakeholders, to implement strategic learning and development and organization development initiatives, to report and measure value add and bottom line commercial growth, and to develop and grow staff and leaders throughout the team and business. So Tim has been doing that for more than 18 years. He's been leading teams himself for about that time. He's got great commercial acumen and stakeholder management skills, and we're about to hear Tim's story now. Tim, welcome to the podcast. It's a great pleasure to have this conversation with you.
Likewise, thanks for inviting me.
Terrific. So, Tim, as is the usual practice here, we like to start with getting to know a bit about the guest. So, it would be wonderful to hear from you about your leadership story, your leadership journey, as we like to say. Where did it start? How did it develop? How did you get to where you are today?
Fantastic. And it's always the easiest subject to talk about yourself. So should be calm and easy.
Yeah,
This is
good.
actually I've been 25 years now in learning and org development, either as a manager or individual contributor or a specialist or a consultant, but in some way, shape or form, 25 years doing learning and org development. But this is actually my third career. So my first career was a PE teacher. Physical education teacher back in Queensland. And I did that for a little while. And then I became a chef. And so I did my accreditation and certification as a chef. And eventually started managing hotels. And then by complete chance, a lady named Anne Simmons invited me to join corporate training, and I stepped across from hospitality into corporate training and never looked back. So it's amazing how much of my first two careers I bring into this.
Yeah, fantastic.
So yeah.
Yeah, would love to hear more about that. What was it? I mean, can you look back now and see a theme that connects those three careers?
Yeah, the PE teaching, I graduated in the top 4% of all teachers in Queensland, but at that
Okay.
time they were only accepting the top 2%
Oh
into full-time roles because there was a glut of teachers coming out of university. And so I took a couple of six-month contracts, one out west in Charleville, which
no.
is Western
Right.
Queensland, as far as you
Yeah.
can go,
Yeah.
and another one in Toowoomba.
Yeah.
And so at the end of those 2 6-month contracts, I still couldn't secure a full-time permanent role. So I became a kids club coordinator over at Kingfisher Bay Resort on Fraser Island. And I thought,
Right.
that is my dream job, hanging out on an offshore island, teaching kids how to play beach volleyball. That
That sounds
dream
like way too
was,
much fun.
oh yeah, and it was an absolute utopia pipe dream. No chance that kids on holidays were ever going to listen to me. So I got a bit jaded and I thought, no, I'll go back to teaching. And there were some positions back in Hervey Bay. So I was going to head back to Hervey Bay. And by chance, I had befriended the executive chef, Jerry DeSantos. And he said to me, "You're going to make a fine chef one day."
Right.
Absolutely out of the blue. We were playing indoor soccer on the tennis courts. And he said that to me. And I said, "Jerry, what are you talking about?" And he said, "You will make a fine chef one day." Anyway, I didn't think anything of it. About 2 weeks later, I was about to resign. And Jerry saw me at the HR manager's office, came by, swung by, and he said, "I've got all those chef papers ready for you to sign up." And I said, What are you
What did
talking about?"
he know?
He saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. And I ended up doing 3 years of my apprenticeship with Jerry in the kitchens at Kingfisher Bay Resort. And then my final year was at the Gazebo Hotel in Brisbane. And I still keep in contact with Jerry and thank him for, discovering me. Yeah, 30
Yeah.
years ago, over 30 years ago. And so that started, my career in
Yeah.
hospitality.
Yeah. That is so amazing. Did you ever discover from Jerry what it was he saw in you,
It
or was he
was
just being opportunistic?
a bit of both, I think. It was
Yeah.
more he saw the right behaviors and values.
Okay.
And it's always touted, when you're going for recruitment or recruiting for roles, everyone talks about that values fit with the business.
Yeah.
For Jerry, it was a lot more personal than that. It was how will you and I get along?
Right.
And do you behave in a way that ticks all of my values boxes as the executive chef? Am I going to have trouble from you? Because some of the other executive chefs that, sorry, some of the other apprentice chefs that were there didn't last long
Yeah.
because they didn't display the values and the behaviors. Because Jerry said all along, "I can teach you anything. I can teach you how to cook. I can teach you how to flambe. I can teach you how to create stock from scratch. I can do all of that. I can teach you all of that if you're open-minded enough to listen to me."
Yeah.
And so when we're becoming friends, playing soccer on the indoor nets, we'd talk about a lot of things.
Yeah.
And he was very appreciative of me remembering all of the things that he had said.
Yeah.
He said, "If you can remember that, you can remember how
Yeah,
to,
a recipe.
fillet a fish, you know." So the biggest kind of thread that kept coming through was my style of teaching, but also my style of learning. So when I was going through uni, I had a certain way I liked to learn, and it was in large groups. Same in the kitchen. I used to love when there was 20 of us standing around a bench and Jerry was teaching us how to fillet a salmon or fillet a tuna. I was mesmerized and everyone was asking all these questions. I thought, "That's a great question. I want to learn that as well." And so when I was managing hotels, I started to put together individual development plans for all of my leaders. And Anne and her wife, her husband, sorry, Derek, used to come into, we had two restaurants. We had 50 rooms and a function center. And Anne and Derek used to come into one of the restaurants every Friday night without fail. And they said, "In the last 6 to 12 months, we've seen a massive change in this hotel, but it's not aesthetics, it's the service. The service, we cannot question the service. How did you get the service so good?" I said, "Oh, hang here. I went out and grabbed my folder of all these individual development plans and showed Anne. And she went, I'm a director at an RTO that does corporate training for retail and hospitality clients. Can you do this with them? And so I
You are
thought, oh.
ahead of yourself, Tim, weren't
I had
you?
no idea. I
Absolutely
had
ahead
no
of
idea.
yourself. Yeah,
I was
there are,
doing it
but there are a couple of things in there that I think are really wonderful in terms of thinking about careers and career development. And one of them, apart from that, people being able to identify your skills and capabilities and to want to work with you, but there's also the idea of priming. So especially when you're younger and you really perhaps don't know what it's like to work or don't know what it's like to do work in all sorts of different organizations and places and use different skills and capabilities, that idea that someone primes you with this idea that you can do this is very powerful, isn't it? Because the earlier on the soccer field, you've got this idea, it's there and you're intrigued by that, and because you're a learner with that great growth mindset, you'll think, you're starting to be curious about what does that mean. And then a bit later, very tactically, Jerry's coming and saying, hey, have I got a job for you? And you're in the right kind of mindset from a growth perspective, but also the right position in terms of what's happening next for me. Beautiful timing.
And it is a lot of my career has been right place, right time. I haven't actually gone for roles. Probably four out of my last 10 roles I've actually applied for
Applied
and gone
for.
through the process. Others have been, we want you to do this job, or now that you've come in and consulted with us, we want you to stay. So there's a lot of try before you buy with my career. When I look through my CV, I'm proud, but I'm also a little touch embarrassed because I only stay for 2 years at a time. And it's always worried me. It's always been in the back of my mind. What would another person's perception be of those 2 year stints? And I talked about it with my previous boss and said to her, how did that strike you when you were talking to me about consulting in at Metro Trains? How did the 2 week 2 year cycle land with you? And she said, didn't faze me because there's a rapid 2 to 2.5 years is the likely span for millennials, for example. And the older you get, the more you want to sit in a role. And I said, I hate sitting in a role.
Yeah, that's ageism right there. But
That's
anyway,
exactly right. Yes. And she is younger than me. So, but yeah, it's the we're in a financial position here at home that means I don't have to work, but I want to work and I want to add value and I want to, do transformational work. As soon as it becomes transactional, that's when I move it on. And so,
I mean, you're
but
in a great position in your sort of role to help really challenge this idea. I mean, you can be, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 3 months, whatever, in roles and be amazing and outstanding and move on, and it's all about growth and development. You can be in those roles for the same amount of time and do a lousy job and doing a lousy job in different places. You can be in the
Yep.
same job, same organization for 25 years, do an outstanding job on a continuing basis, or do a lousy job on a continuing basis. I mean, I think, partly from a, in terms of projecting yourself out into the world, it's really about how you tell your story, and you tell your story in a very, very compelling way.
And it's always surprising when I go back and look at all of the achievements. Every CV has job description and then the achievements. And especially in this role that I'm currently in, it never ceases to amaze me the career defining initiatives and projects that we're currently rolling out. you would expect to do in 5 to 7 years. We've done it in 12 months. And so it's that mass, the business desperately wants what we've got. So let's keep pumping it out. Let's keep rolling it out. And so you're exactly right. That could have taken us 5 to 7 years, but instead it's taken us 12 months. And so in the next 12 months, we've got another batch of initiatives that we're going to kick off and build the foundation of LNOD within Metro. And then it will probably become transactional at year three, or the end of year three, beginning of year four. And that's when I'll be looking for the next challenge. And whether that's in Metro or outside of Metro, that's just how my career development brain works. If it's transformational and we're making massive impacts and we're creating a lot of value for our businesses, happy days. And I'll stay there as long as I possibly can. As soon as it becomes transactional, or the value's not there, or the impact's not there, or it's not wanted, that's okay. I'll pack up my bag and move on to the next one.
Sounds very exciting. So let's just come back to your career. And we have talked about career and how it started and those threads that come through. If we focus on leadership for a moment, I mean, as a learning and organization development person, one of the things that you're most focused on, obviously, is leadership skills and capabilities. But let's talk about yours. How did you get into leadership roles, and how do you see, that kind of leadership and influencing play out in the kind of work you do now?
That's an interesting one. I think there's a, nature versus nurture. When I was going through uni, we had a org psych lecturer, John Ledet, never forget him. The most boring person on the face of the earth, but so knowledgeable, so knowledgeable. And this is a tribute. So John always used to wear a brown cardigan. So I've put on my cardigan for John today. But he used to talk about Piaget's theory of developmental learning. So knowledge, comprehension, application, analysis, synthesis, evaluation. And he used to drum it into us. When we do our LNOD practice now, that's foremost in my head. Yes, we can teach people change theories. Then we can ask them, what did they understand from those change theories? Then how would they apply it? How would they analyze other situations where they can apply it? Then how do they synthesize it into their daily routine so that it's a daily leadership practice? And then evaluate what's next. What other theories can I add into this mix? When it comes to my progression through Piaget's theory of developmental learning, it's for kids, but it applies equally for adults. I think about what did I bring to my roles. Even as a PE teacher, I wanted to be the head PE teacher. Even as an apprentice chef, I wanted to be a demi chef and a sous chef, and then an executive chef. I always wanted that kind of leadership, even today. So I volunteer with SES Victoria, and I couldn't stay as a member. Now I'm a deputy controller, and I just crave those leadership roles. I don't know why. It's something inherent in me. I want to be leading a team, setting a vision, be strategic, all that kind of stuff. And so each of the roles I've had, each of the leadership roles I've had, my one-up manager has always tapped into that yearning desire that I have to be a leader. They then teach me the stuff I don't know. And I've been very, very fortunate to have some outstanding leaders, one-up leaders, who teach me the stuff I don't know. And further develop me as a leader. So, we talk at Metro about success profiles, and we talk about the top 16 capabilities for any leader. The first thing I did was when our executive director created the success profile for our team, I immediately self-assessed and went into those 16 capabilities, whether it's transferable skills, leadership behaviors, personal traits or knowledge. And I went into those and seriously reflected and went, do I have those capabilities? If I didn't, I went and got them.
Yeah.
And so part of that leadership style or leadership roles, you're always learning something. You're always getting better as a leader. And I take a lot of feedback on board from my direct reports, but also my peers and colleagues and my stakeholders, so the full 360, because I want to be better year on year. I want to be better. Otherwise, I'm going stale. And that's throughout my career, throughout. So always keen to do a basketball seminar when I was PE teaching. Loved watching some Cordon Bleu chefs and how they do their business because I wanted to do that. I've seen some amazing L&D leaders in the last 25 years who I want to be like that, and drives me towards that leadership style.
So that's a huge growth mindset, always wanting to improve, get better, and to do that in almost an upwards way, looking at what's the next version of the role that I've got, what do I need to do to get there? To what extent have you thought about, moving into roles that aren't, well, that are leadership roles, but don't have that explicit L&OD focus?
When I was at AGL, I'll never forget, Graham Horn was the GM for retail operations. He was my GM and he was overt with challenging people. So what that looked like was I was sitting in Graham's office and he said, all this leadership stuff that you spout, what do you really know about leadership? And I said, heaps, I've managed hotels and I've managed teams. And he said, yeah, but what do you really know about leadership? And I said, well, what did you have in mind? And he said, I'm glad you asked. I want you to become the National New Connections Manager. So, New Connection, you're building a house, you need a builder's temporary supply pole and cable to go into the house so that the builders can use electricity while they're building your house. I want you to manage that team. And there were 65 people in that team. They covered four states. I knew zero about New Connections, absolutely nothing. And I did that for 18 months and smashed all my targets. And I was really happy with the way the team performed. And I had nothing to do with that really. It was all the team's process or systems or continuous improvement, and I was just moving the chess pieces. But at the end of the 18 months, I remember Graham Horn coming back and going, all right, so all that leadership stuff that you were spouting, how much of it are you going to keep after doing this 18-month stint? And I said, not a lot of it. So it was that absolute in the trenches, real world leadership I've now taken to a lot of my other L&OD roles. And I'll always thank Graham Horn for giving me that opportunity to step into an operational role that I knew nothing about. And I had to be a leader. I couldn't be a manager. I couldn't be a
Because you
specialist and
didn't
be
know
in,
the technical.
had no idea. And so I was always thankful for Graham giving me that opportunity because I reflect on it a lot. When I was at Telstra, I had 110 people in my team. It was still L&OD, but 110 people is a lot. And I had seven direct reports. They all had their teams. And that to me was like I was GM of learning. So I was stepping back out of my specialist, becoming that coach and guide and developer for my teams. And so my specialty, which is design or practice, I stepped out of and let them
Do
be the
that.
specialists. And I did that on the back of what I did at AGL. And so, consciously take that step back, be the leader, don't be the specialist. And I've carried that into other roles as well.
But back to that kind of question, you have reverted back into L&OD rather than taking a general management kind of position after that AGL experience. So what was that about?
I could see I liked L&OD. Not I liked operations, but not as much. And I could have easily stepped into general management and general operations, but I wanted to continue on that. Ever since I was, well, my mum used to say to me, ever since you were 6 years old, you wanted to be a teacher, because on school holidays, she's got this grainy old picture of me standing in front of a chalkboard teaching my twin brother and my younger brother maths when I was 6 years old. So I've always wanted to be a teacher. I've always wanted to teach people stuff. So that's the L&OD bent, and the individual development plans back at the
Plans.
hotels. Everything was about teaching others. And so general operations, general management didn't really offer that teaching as such. I wanted to teach people how to be a leader. I wanted to teach them how to be a coach. I wanted to teach them how to get the most out of employee engagement or DE&I or whatever it is that I wanted to impart some knowledge on. And then also gain their knowledge. So the L&OD bent is a 46-year bent. And so I could have quite easily gone down that ops role, but I just thought my contribution and my value is better served in an
Another
L&OD
way.
capacity.
Look, that's a critical nexus, as you know. So many leaders face it when they're kind of on the fast track, the high potentials, wanting to progress in their career. There is that challenge about whether you leave behind what it is you're most passionate about, which is usually the technical professional skills and capabilities, your profession, and move into general management. And for some people, that's an amazing step and it's great. And for others, it's just that technical professional is too much a part of my identity. It's too hard. I can't leave it behind.
Exactly.
But yeah, I mean, a great way to find that out. For other people, that whole fitting into leadership is a much more difficult kind of proposition. We were talking in an earlier conversation, about, let's say it, imposter syndrome, and an experience that you've had recently that's helped you to think quite differently about the ease or discomfort that people feel around leadership.
Yeah, and it's always ever present. So even though I know I'm good at things, I will still always have that level of self-doubt, which is, am I really that good? Am I good enough? Even, to be completely honest and transparent about this interview, am I really a person that someone would want to listen to,
Absolutely, yes.
very kind, Karen, but
Having those
always.
thoughts hasn't, the good news is having those kinds of thoughts hasn't stopped you from having the conversation, which is a terrific one.
That's right. And I do, so we recently had an event with Metro Trains on International Women's Day, and it was a fantastic event. We heard from four groups of speakers from around Metro, about women in leadership roles. And the whole day kicked off, or the whole event kicked off with our CEO, Raymond O'Flaherty, saying everyone suffers from imposter syndrome, even him. And he talked at length about some of the self-doubt, some of the, am I really that good? Am I good enough? And there were two other presentations during the day that also talked about imposter syndrome. One was specifically about imposter syndrome and all the self-doubt and all the words that go through our heads, and how do we quell it, but use it. And the other one was women in infrastructure roles within Metro. It's a heavily male-dominated part of Metro, but it's vastly and quickly becoming more gender parity, which is brilliant. And some of the female infrastructure leaders who spoke talked about, why am I in this job? Why, as an engineer, why am I with these sets of engineers? What makes me as good as them? What makes me part of that group? And so they talked about some of the self-doubt that they experience as well. So it's good to hear that everyone suffers from it. It's about how do we channel it into something far more constructive. So it's good to, I think, based on our conversation, it's good to have it. It's just how do we use it?
And most people feel, though, unfortunately, that it's kind of bad to have it, and they allow it to kind of erode their confidence. But as you know, this is something that I've been speaking and writing about, and I'm quite passionate about the whole idea of imposter syndrome, and really want to stop us from using that term, imposter syndrome, because it isn't a syndrome. And I think for some people, calling it a syndrome makes it become a thing. And then that thing kind of captures you, and it captures the way you deal with that. I mean, I think what your CEO and other leaders have done by speaking about the fact that they feel like imposters from time to time, and show then how they are successful in the roles that they have. I mean, that's fantastic role modeling. Because and the research actually shows that if you're less certain, if you have more doubt about yourself and your capabilities, that you actually perform better as a leader, because you don't get trapped into thinking you're thinking you know everything. You think you've always got the answers, and then you might not even listen to your team. So that's a kind of a path that is, I think, more common than we'd like it to be. So, I mean, there are loads of things to really be thinking about, but I think for you've framed this in a really positive way. And I think that's what we need to do. We need to be careful about labeling stuff, making it a thing, but surfacing the conversation. What does it mean to have this kind of sense of anxiety about having to do something? Actually means you're human.
And I loved your when we last spoke talk about labeling it as a syndrome, because then I'm sick, I've got a syndrome. You're not, you're human. Everyone has. And so what would you, I'm going to turn the microphone back on you. What would you call it? If not imposter syndrome, what would you call it?
I think there are a lot of words that are caught up in identifying what imposter syndrome or imposter phenomenon, as it was originally sort of labeled, are. So it's feeling like a fraud, having self-doubt, feeling uncertain. I would actually start to use the words that people, or the emotions, for what people are feeling and experiencing. So, I feel a threat because I'm in a context where I'm unusual or different. So there's a lot of identity threat caught up in it. Or I feel a lack of confidence because I'm going to do something that I haven't done before. Or, like in this conversation, I'm putting myself on a stage, and I should feel a little bit of nervousness about that. That's pretty human. And so I would be thinking about things like feeling doubt. I'd even label it doubt and not self-doubt. I'd be using words that are fairly normal, and thinking about that sort of fight or flight syndrome. That's what happens. How do I label what I'm feeling? The more words we can use to label that feeling or that experience, the better, because then we can talk about it in all sorts of different ways, and we can then think about a whole series of different options for what we do. So we don't want to suppress it, because suppressing bad thoughts, negative thoughts, uncomfortable thoughts actually tends to magnify them. So we don't want to do it. I think exactly what happened in your International Women's Day event, people are talking about it, is fantastic. And then it's a bit like, okay, what do we do to take advantage of the uncertainty that we feel? And or if I'm not confident, I'm not confident because I haven't had experience of this, I haven't practiced this, I don't have feedback on my performance in this. So how do I go about building those skills or that, experience? And I think for women in infrastructure or anybody who's a minority in a particular group is likely to feel identity threat. So understanding that and what identity threat is and helping people to feel supported in environments where they are unusual, different, is really helpful.
We did talk about the one of. I'm the only
Yeah.
female. I'm the only Indigenous person, First
Yeah.
Nations person. So yeah,
Yeah.
that one of
Yeah.
we did talk about a lot, and
Yeah.
I'll always remember the our diversity and inclusion manager before he left for Queensland kept on saying, we don't need a women's leadership program. Women don't need to be fixed.
Yeah.
So what needs to be fixed is everything outside of that. So the culture, the gender parity, the pay gaps, everything else needs focus and attention. You know, there's these female leaders that we have, especially within Metro, are exceptional.
Yes.
There is not one that you would turn around and go, yeah, it's a bit questionable. They are exceptional. And I tended to agree with the D&I manager saying, well, what can we do to help?
Yeah.
And so it's not about suppressing those doubtful thoughts, but it's more about giving the environment and culture a crack. Let's give that a focus
Yeah.
so that the level of self-doubt actually automatically goes down, because I'm not a one of, I'm not the only person here. Everyone suffers the same as I do. So let's talk about the role, not the person. Let's talk about the environment, not the gender. Let's deal with that as a focus point.
Absolutely. I think that's just right. And for more senior leaders, even though the CEO feels these doubts, that doesn't get in the way of his effectiveness and performance. So it is about coaching down to around what do we need to do to make this environment more welcoming for you, where you don't feel like you are so unusual, even if you are, or how we manage to give you voice, or, that whole psychological safety piece is really important there. And, leaders who can, help people understand the value of difference, and give space to people.
And that's a
Those are the sorts of things that go a really long way.
really great output from these sorts of conversations. I mean, our CEO to be vulnerable enough to talk about his personal thoughts and perceptions, our whole exec team are 100% behind him. And he definitely leads by example. So he is demonstrating excellence every day he steps onto a metro station or a train, he or a depot. He demonstrates excellence and really values our contribution from a LNOD perspective, really values our contribution because we're helping make Metro a better place to work. And that's often a tagline for a recruitment or an EVP, but he genuinely wants Metro to be a brilliant place for everyone to come to work. And so every time we offer an initiative or a project or a program that's going to help the culture or help the environment, the exec team are 100% behind it. And that's why we can, fast track a lot of these career defining initiatives. We can fast track them because we have executive support and sponsorship for
And alignment. I mean
it.
that, I mean, I could just hear it. I think, oh, I want to work there. That's It's really
Yeah.
exciting. I can just
Absolutely.
hear
Yep.
the energy in your voice as you speak about him and the context. So that's
Yep.
just amazing. That's a great story.
Yeah.
And so just as we finish up, Tim, I mean, there are many more things that we could talk about, but especially given your role as heading up learning and organization development and being in that position of, working so much with leaders and shaping the current and the future, I mean, what advice would you give to leaders about what they should be focusing on for their development? I mean, there are too many things that everybody needs to do in their day. So if they're going to think about themselves and their future, what do you think they should be focusing on?
One of our key focus areas over the last probably 18 months is provide leaders what they need. And what our leaders need is data, really, really good data. So whether it's a success profile assessment, whether it's a 360, whether it's a Hogan assessment, whether it's a talent assessment, anything data oriented for them to make really great decisions about their development. Too often we leave it for leaders to self-evaluate, self-assess, and come up with some development options for them. Instead, what we're doing, and one of the key tips and tricks for getting that capability development of our leaders is saying, here's the expectation. Here are the top 16 capabilities that you in that role need to have and hold and possess and do every single day of your life. Do you do it? And if not, put it in your capability development plan. We'll give you that capability development so that you can go back to those 16 and with a tick go, yep, I am fully capable in my current role. And so all of that data, whether it's Hogan personality traits, whether it's a 360 review of values and behaviors, whether it's success profile assessment with your leader, performance reviews. Everyone cringes when we say performance reviews, but they are a great source
Got to
of,
do them well.
that's right, and they've got to be a great source of capability development. If you didn't hit it, or if you didn't exceed that KPI, why not? What was it? Was it systems, process, environment, or was it you? And if it's you, let's get you some development so that you can get that next time. As much data as possible. The second part is that executive sponsorship and ownership. So a lot of our initiatives are leader-led. We've got a Think Twice program rolling out at the moment, which is think twice about walking past those psychological behaviors. We talk about being an upstander, not a bystander. We talk about human-centered approach to
Excellent.
these issues. And so we asked our senior leaders from CEO down to roll out the program on our behalf because it's not our program, it's their program. And they're the ones we teach them some key topics and concepts, and then we ask them to teach forward and to teach their teams about what they've learned and what they've personally got out of it. So that leader-led approach has been remarkable in its impact to the frontline team members because it's not an L&OD team coming out and spruiking stuff. It is my leader who's telling me, these are the expectations of a leader in Metro. This is what I'm going to live up to. This is what I want you to live up to. Let's talk about it.
That's brilliant, Tim. I mean, it's kind of a simple, but it's actually hard to get it to happen, and it doesn't happen anywhere near enough. If you want your leaders to do things, have the leader role models. Do
That's
them, and
right.
then you can kind of plug, if you like, the capability gaps and support people kind of in getting there. But I mean, it's a simple but brilliant concept. So it's
Yeah.
fantastic to hear how it's working and how you're getting it to work.
And it's something I've been thinking about for many roles, but this is the first time it's actually worked. And it is exactly as you said, it's because we have those role models up on level 17. They're the ones who demonstrate excellence. And so the depot manager in Epping can point his or her finger back up to Raymond, our CEO, and say, see, he does it.
Yeah.
So we're going to do it. You know, and you can draw the line through all the levels of leadership. Everyone's doing the same thing for the right reasons.
Yeah.
And probably the third is never stop learning yourself. I recall when I had a role, I just started in a role, and my boss said to me, I need a coach, because everyone in this organization gets a coach. And I said, I don't need a coach. I don't want a coach. And I remember having a conversation down in a coffee shop downstairs where I was working, and Dr. Karen Morley came in to me and said, I'm your coach. What do you want to be coached in? And I remember saying to you, yeah, I'm doing this to tick a box. You know, everyone here needs a coach. And within 5 minutes, you had me summed up. You had me, I was writing copious notes about the things I wanted to develop, and you were the coach. So never stop learning yourself. Never stop questioning, reflecting. They're often soft HR words, you know, stop and reflect about what you've just learned. There's a practical basis to that. And so, especially in this role and some of the consulting I did prior, I would always, what could I have done better? What do I need to learn in order to make this more successful? And, you know, I credit you for that. I was still probably.
Well, I was working with a very well formed canvas there, wasn't I?
But
you were much more open to that learning and coaching than perhaps you seemed or sounded.
Realistically, my ego got in the way of learning, and you managed to bust through the bluff and bravado and say, that's what I'm talking about right there. That's what you need to work on and develop and critically reflect. And so, as a 25 years is a long time to be doing a particular profession. And I find since my coaching, I've accumulated a lot more knowledge and a lot more information than I ever have in the previous 20 years. So I think it was about 5 years ago to the day that I started that coaching with you.
Wow.
And it's made a difference. Every single post-implementation review or post-project review, we're always critically assessing and reflecting, and what could we have done better? What didn't go so well? And celebrate what really went well. Let's bank that. Let's put that into the next initiative, and let's tweak and modify this. And we do that really openly with our heads of people or with our executive directors or with our champions within the business. We do it really overtly and really honestly and openly so that they start to bring that practice into their own business unit. You know, it's not just us talking about it. It's actually implemented in the very next project.
Well, thank you for those words. And I think it was just what it kind of demonstrates is that a tiny boost or a tiny challenge to someone who's willing to learn can make a huge difference, more than you might think, more than I think.
Yep, no massive difference.
Well, thank you, Tim. And thank you so much for the conversation. We'll wrap up now, but it's been really interesting going back to your career and hearing about those threads in it and how you got to where you are today. A lot of lessons and things for people, the listeners, to think about. And also, you know, that idea about imposter syndrome, we're absolutely on that same wavelength about how can we break that out a little bit so that we're able to focus for people on something that's positive and constructive and can take them forward. And thanks for your advice about what leaders need to be focusing on and how they might do that. So, it's been a great conversation. I really appreciate it. And fantastic to hear about the current role and how well that's going, or the context that you're working in is.
And thanks again for giving me that challenge, and also for the opportunity to open another discussion with you. I love the books, I love the blogs, love the podcasts. So great to be involved. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Tim. Thanks.